Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, offering crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com.
This edition of Commodity Week was recorded August the 6th.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists today include Merrill Crowley of Crowley Commodities out of Watseka, Illinois, Chad Hart, Extension Agricultural Economist from Iowa State University, Bill Mayer of Strategic Farm Marketing out of Champaign, Illinois, and Dan Zwicker of CGB Enterprises from Mandeville, Louisiana. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. We'll begin, as usual, with a list of topics to discuss, starting with Bill Mayer of Strategic Farm Marketing.
Yeah, I think obviously the report next week. I would like to discuss corn demand a little bit and just kind of get a feel from the group as far as where they think the USDA is as far as demand, high, low, maybe some reasoning why they feel that way.
Merrill Crowley.
Same thing. Maybe discuss some of the economics, like the Fed raising interest rates or the dollar up, how it might affect the markets.
Okay, and Dan Zwicker?
Well, I think you got to talk about the world economic situation. I mean, we have had a global meltdown in commodities. Now, the question here is, are the equities the next leg to fall here?
And finally, Chad Hart, ag economist at Iowa State University.
Well, I'll probably spin off of that and say let's look at global energy as well. One of the things that has been helping us on the corn side had been ethanol exports, but those are now starting to tail off. And so you wonder if that leg of the demand stool is starting to weaken a little bit.
Okay, I'll take that up with you momentarily, but I want to go back a week. And you were out at the Agricultural Economics Association meeting, and I happened to see that you were in front. About the time that you posted this, it was put up on Twitter that you were looking at a national average yield for corn, and you're in the middle of Iowa, so I thought this was interesting, at 162. Is that correct, and how did you arrive at it?
That was correct, and here's how I got there. So when I look at the USDA reports, one of the key ones I look at is that crop progress report. I've built a little model over the past few years that takes that crop conditions report and sort of, you know, put a time trend with it, and actually does a pretty decent job of estimating national yields. That model right now as it stands would push me towards a national yield of 170. But I also know what the weaknesses in this model is, and it tends to be if a crop stress when we get into the grain fill period in August and we get warmer than usual summer nights, you get the discount that yield that comes out of this model, and usually on the order of about 8 bushels per acre. And that's how I ended up at the 162, as you'll look here. It's really, as I'm staring at it, a case of will the northern and western corn belt make up for what you're seeing across the southern and eastern parts? When I look at the crops down in Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, we definitely see the stress of too much water throughout most of the growing season. When I've been up to the north and west, the South Dakota, especially the northwest Iowa crop, southwest Minnesota crop, they're looking better than they've had in almost at any time. We're looking at some phenomenal yields coming up there. And so it's this balancing act, figuring out which one is going to be the bigger impact when we look at the national yield. When I hit that 162, I was betting that the eastern crop's a little worse than the western crop is better.
Yeah, so you are one of the few, I think, that is actually calculating the crop that way. Can you justify it?
Can I justify it? Sure. Like I say, you know, I go back over history. When I look at this model that I've used, it fits about, explains about 92% of the corn yield variation that we've seen over the past 30 years as far as the national yield is concerned. And so it does a pretty good job. Like I say, if it's got a weakness, it's probably this grain fill period in August that we're in right now, trying to figure that out. Like I say, if you have a good long grain fill period, this model tends to underpredict. If you have a shorter one, hotter temperatures at nighttime, it tends to overpredict.
What did your colleagues say?
Colleagues were actually fairly quiet. I mean, I think this is one of those deals of it depends on where you're at in the country.
I know Scott Irwin and Ed Ussett probably weren't that quiet, were they?
Well, actually, they were. That was what was scary. You know, when you think about it, when I talk to the folks like Scott, and you know, down in Illinois, and I talk to all the folks out at Purdue, the folks at Ohio State, of course, they're looking at their local crops going, yeah, things look really rough. At the same time, too, when I talk to my colleagues at South Dakota State up at University of Minnesota, the idea is they're staring at some of the grass crops they've seen in their lives. And so it's trying to figure out, okay, which one of these is going to weigh more heavily as we look at that national crop yield? And I got to admit, here in Iowa, I'm sort of caught in between. I've done some field days where I've been standing in some absolutely beautiful cornfields. I've also done a couple of field days where it's one of these deals of, I've described it as too many shades of green out in the fields. We're used to one consistent shade of green, and instead I've got anything from almost a pale yellow up to a nice vibrant green out there in that field, and that bothers you a little bit when you're sitting here in August staring at that corn crop.
Speaking of shades of green, from Watseka, Illinois, Merrill Crowley is in the middle, I believe, of one of the worst areas in the Corn Belt. What are conditions like today there? I was there a couple of weeks ago. I suspect they haven't gotten a lot better, at least for corn, maybe for soybeans. What do you see on the ground?
Well, it looks better. I mean, things have greened up. You've got all the corn trying to tassel, even though it's 2 foot tall and no ear on it. Or if it does have an ear, they're not going to be able to harvest it. The guys that I talk to are talking about going out, and some of the better stuff that they see out here is still a problem area. They're talking about a girth of 12 instead of the normal 14 or 16. So length is okay on some of the better corn that they're seeing. It's just the girth is missing. And then along the lines of trying to balance out the condition report, because like I said, we're in a poor situation. I went back and took the change from Good to Excellent from last year and used it, taking the yield of last year with the change in the Good to Excellent categories and trying to weight it out. And it was kind of interesting that when I do that with the last report, I get a yield for corn of roughly, if I can find it here in front of my face, 161.3, and for beans I get 43.6.
These are statewide yields or national yields?
These would be national.
National yields.
Based on a change in the good to excellent category from year to year, the yield the state had last year, each state had last year, and the amount of acres they are to harvest this year.
Just for reference, the crop progress reports in the five top corn-producing states in the nation in normal order, this isn't always the order it happens in, Iowa this past week on Monday was 83% good to excellent. Illinois, number two, was 56%. Nebraska, number three, 75%. Minnesota's the number four producer of corn in the nation, 87% good to excellent, a phenomenal number. And Indiana at 47%. And I was pretty sure that USDA had a common standard for what good to excellent means, but it does can be a little subjective. I emailed Lance Honig and checked that. In fact, they do have a common standard, but of course it can be subjective. I suspect that 87% good to excellent in Minnesota, maybe we haven't seen this good a crop ever before. So those are the numbers, but as you divide that up, then you put Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota versus Illinois and Indiana. You have a pretty weighted situation, which, Chad, you referred to. And I'm wondering, Bill Mayer, when you called around to the other offices in your organization in Strategic Farm Marketing, how they see the variation from one side of the Corn Belt to the other?
Well, it's definitely a west to east situation. I think the reports on the ground that we get pretty much back up what the condition reports are saying there, and what we've been talking about as far as, you know, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, where they end up, you know, the Minnesota crop, our reports from up there, we got quite a few clients up in Minnesota, and they definitely are looking at, and for the most part, you know, possibility of record yield. So whenever we put our numbers together, we kind of went that route and did a state-by-state estimates and came up somewhere in that 163 area. So I guess I'd like to kind of maybe switch gears a little bit there and just let's look at what the trade's expecting. I think that from a price standpoint, that's really kind of important. And when I look at the average guesses here and stuff, the one I saw today was 164.7 on the corn yield and a carry out of 1.45 to 1.6, basically. It looks to me like the ability for the trade to get surprised to the upside, you know, to the bearish side, is maybe not quite as good odds as the possibility of a surprise lower. I don't know, you know, where things are going to come in, but it seems like we're at some pretty common numbers. That's kind of where the trade's at, I believe, is somewhere in that 164.65 on yield and somewhere around 1.5 to 1.6 on the carryout number. So I think that really, as we go into next Wednesday, the reaction will be based more on that than it will be, you know, where the yield comes in necessarily.
Dan, what do you think about yield and ending stocks for the coming year?
Oh, I don't think we're going to know till January, to tell you the truth. But I guess it'll make it fun going through the crop reporting season. I guess my memory's not as good as it used to be, but for the most part, August crop reports, from my memory, have a tendency to be on the higher side of the equation, because I think of their strict methodology. It's just looking at plant population and multiplying by average this and average that. And I don't know if USDA will fade that any in the Eastern Corn Belt or not. You know, that's their judgment. But I would say the way the trade actually took both the FC Stone number and the Informa number at 165-ish, actually, I think a lot of the trade was thinking that they might be higher than that, because the market actually closed higher on those report numbers. Now, today we did back off a little bit, but I think the trade is kind of thinking that USDA is going to try to, you know, we'll come in there kind of where that FC Stone numbers are and where the Informa numbers, if not slightly higher. The key, of course, is going to be what the acreage changes are.
Bill, can I come back to you real quick? And I don't know whether you will have an answer for this or not. Have you thought about what crop insurance may pay for those producers that are hurt really bad at this point and how that works? Have you looked at it yet?
Well, the worst hurt ones, the ones with the big prevent plant numbers, you know, it's pretty easy to figure that. And there's, you know, so those claims are already underway and some of them getting close to getting paid. As far as the RRP, you know, the revenue protection policy, really our prices, we're 415 in the spring for corn and we've come down some. So, you know, on average yield, you'd probably be getting right at the place right now where you'd be getting some payments. If you're, you know, an average yield and these price levels that we have here in October, but that's two big ifs, you know, as we go forward. So we are starting to see some areas where they're, you know, they are doing some failed acres in some areas, northeastern Illinois, northwestern Indiana especially. And, you know, we are starting to see some of that. But as far as knowing, you know, where we're at as far as claims go, it's down the road a ways yet.
Chad, have you traveled Iowa enough to know what prevent plant acres look like in your state? And I've heard a couple of different things. Of course, we're all aware of northwestern Missouri, southwestern Iowa being really late. I suspect there may be quite a few prevent plant acres in that area. But I've also heard that throughout the state, especially along the western edge, that there might be more prevent plant acres there than many have expected.
Well, we've got some prevent plant acres, and then you got some, let's call it replant situation, roundouts, where, you know, the crop did get planted there, but yeah, it just got washed out as we went through. And it's more a problem, as you say, along the western side of Iowa here, especially as we concentrate on that southwest corner. And then as you drift along the southern border as well, basically, you know, everything that happened in northern Missouri, yeah, you saw that same pattern as we walk across southern Iowa. And so that's one of the wild cards when trying to figure out this yield. I've joked that, you know, it depends on whether, you know, when we roll the combines this fall, whether we roll through those dead spots or around them. If we roll through them, it impacts the yield. If we roll around them, it impacts that harvested area. Either way, it's a lost bushel.
Yeah, so what do you think about acreage?
On the acreage side here, my own sense from Iowa is that, you know, prevent planting, it's going to be bigger than normal. So typically for us, we're, you know, we're south of 100,000 acres of prevent plant. We're probably somewhere on the order of, I'd say, 250,000 when I looked out there. But, you know, we're going to have more problems with the dead spots in the middle of the field showing up as well.
Do you suppose that USDA will find anything very much different on the soybean recount in Kansas, Missouri, and Arkansas?
They just might, at least in traveled some through central Missouri as well. And what I was hearing a lot of was people planting, if you will, their first and second crop beans at the same time. So we did see a strong push there at the end to try to get some crop area in after that survey had went through.
I'd like to change topics now. I think, Merrill, you mentioned interest rates. We'll start there and then work our way through global economics and what Dan termed as the global meltdown in commodities, and we'll probably have to talk about crude oil in the midst of that. Interest rates are on your mind, Merrill, and why is that the case?
Well, I'm just looking at the interest rates. We watched the long-term 30-year bonds going up almost consistently here for the last two or three months, and it certainly looks to me like either the traders don't believe that we're going to see a Fed push interest rates up, or people are searching for a safe haven to put their money. And I think the bonds have been up a little more than, say, the dollar. And I think that's the other reason they're buying into the dollar, is because, A, they're looking for a safe haven, or there are those that are looking for the bonds to go up, so they want their money with the U.S. instead of other countries. We keep talking about the dollar and the interest rates, and we keep saying, well, that's why we're, you know, our dollar's up because of our interest rates, and they're going to go up, and that's going to bring more into it. But our dollar, and I think Dan mentioned this a while back, is not all that high when we look at it, say, back in the 80s or back in the past. The problem is that we are seeing this economy in the world work its way to where, for example, Brazil's economy is probably one of the worst in the world right now. Argentina is having problems. And all these emerging markets are suffering from what's happening in China right now. They've got basically three big bubbles that are trying to pop. One of them was the stock market, which I think has started already. You've got their total debt, and then you have their housing market. Now, if they have those three, and what little bit we've seen the effect from hits them, continues to go through to these other countries, it's concerning whether or not we're going to have the global economy that can sustain prices where they are now. The other thought I had versus this is that if those others break and the U.S. can hold, then I think you're going to see investors looking for commodities as a place for safe haven for their money, because it's always better to own the actual commodity versus a financial instrument.
Dan, you termed this as a global meltdown on commodities. Certainly there are commodities that have been making new lows, gold, crude oil among them. How do you envision the world economic situation?
Well, if you look at, which numbers you look at, I mean, but you've got half the world here in almost financial collapse, starting with Greece at top and Venezuela, and you just keep on going down the line through the Ukraine. China's in trouble. And I guess my question is How much turbulence is that going to create for commodity demand? Because it's obvious that China has made a decision that they don't necessarily want to have the inventory of commodities on hand that they had in the double O's when we were, you know, in a demand-driven market. It's too expensive to hold on to those inventories, so they're liquidating commodity inventories. And I did see an article where they liquidated actually a third of our U.S. their bond holdings in the United States. They've taken $500 million out of the U.S. bond market. They still own $1 trillion. And I guess I'm somewhat concerned if they begin to have to liquidate that $1 trillion of bonds out, how that's going to impact the U.S. markets. But demand, at least up to this point, at least, you know, today was the first day we saw a decent wheat number. I guess it's a marketing year high. We saw a decent soybean export number for new crop. But corn has really been dragging its average pace for this time of year anyway. But, you know, I think that's all going to pick up now with the EU crop situation the way it is right now, at least what it's looking like anyway.
Chad, is there much lag in the world economy as it impacts consumption of commodities, agricultural commodities in general?
Not necessarily. I mean, when you look, the idea that when we see that global economic slowdown, it does tend to turn around and come at us fairly quickly here, and we see some rebalancing of that demand pattern. You know, as you look here, one of the things I've been watching are those advanced export sales for our crops. And as Dancer mentioned, the idea is those had been lagging and you know, continue to sort of drag behind what we've been used to over the past few years. We're just not seeing those forward bookings like we'd like to see, and you can point to the strength in the dollar, the concerns about developing economies out there weighing down on those advanced sales.
You're concerned, Bill, about demand for corn for the coming year?
Well, I guess I'm probably... sounds like maybe a little bit more optimistic than some of the others. I think one of the, to me, it's, I'm a pretty common person, I guess. I think whenever you're looking at the market as the buyers in the foreign countries have been looking at the market for corn, for example, I'm not sure why you would go out and book a lot of advanced sales for new crop as you're looking at probably the likelihood of having lower prices, you know, as we went into the fall harvest period. I see a couple of issues, I think, as far as the economy, global economy goes. One is, I think you've got to look from the standpoint of longer term. I think longer term, as you look out, I think you continue to see the demand for what we are talking about here, corn, soybeans, wheat, I think, and livestock. I think you see those continue to grow from a global standpoint. You're going to have hiccups, and I think we're seeing some of those hiccups, and we'll continue to see some as we move forward. But I guess I, you know, barring some unforeseen catastrophe or whatever, I'm not sure that I see a long-term effect from the growth standpoint as I look forward. I guess the other issue I think that we deal with all the time when it comes to China is just the reliability of the information that you're getting from that sector of the world, and you know, is it manipulation or is it you know, fact sometimes.
Hey Chad, I have another question for you. I was thinking about the demand and consumption side. Along with the supply side, you have a 162 for the national average yield. What do you think ending stocks are for the coming year, and do you have a national average cash price midpoint?
Well, you know, as I'm looking at it right now, and you know, like I say, USDA's already laid out their numbers, and they look at what they were expecting. They were saying that they already expected a little downshift on the feed side. They were looking at, you know, if there was strength building for them there, they were pointing at ethanol and exports. But I think those are the two areas where we're starting to point to and going, are they going to be as strong looking forward as we had once hoped? We've already talked a little bit about how the value of the dollar, concerns about the global economy may be weighing down on the export side, and so I think we could also see the same sort of argument as we look at ethanol. And so while demand has, you know, has been brought up here, demand actually, when we look at the numbers right now, is holding at a very strong level compared to, let's call it long run history. Over the short run, what we're seeing is this, you know, pullback down. So I am looking for ending stocks, even though, you know, I've got a lower yield. I'm expecting the demand number to actually work its way down a little bit as well. So I still end up with an ending stock level, probably in the, you know, right now my models would say in the 1.3 billion bushel range, and that would, you know, hold prices in the 375 to 380 range if we look at that season average price.
Hold it, wait. You're at 1.3 billion carryout, and you've got a 375.
Still holding the price low. Yep.
Why?
And so, and well, in this case, it's because, again, looking at that demand side, and is there really room to pick it back up again? And like I say, I am getting a little bit concerned about some of the slowdowns we're seeing in exports and ethanol as to whether we can maintain price levels out there. In fact, when I looked at, you know, futures close of day yesterday, ran them through a season average price calculator for the 15 crop, I was getting a number in the 365 range. And so right now the market's actually trading below the estimate I've got running out there.
Well, I was kind of hoping that you would give us good news, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I would only say that if the crop is down in that lower 160s or 162 or 163, I really do think once the trade begins to recognize that, if that is it, and I'm not too sure we'll really know that probably in we'll get much of a whiff of that until the combines start rolling sometime in September. But if there is a whiff of the yield being down in the low 160s, I think that would probably bring in a lot of buying in this market through the fall months. And I think now it may all come at us at once and give us, you know, a good rally through the fall. Like some of my Ouija board stuff does weigh that out, that this thing could rally into mid-December. Now, I want to go plus or minus, you know, 30 days, 45 days on that, and then fall back into a spring low. So that would kind of act like a short crop year where you'd make a high, you know, early in the marketing year season, and then you go into a tailspin into the spring, and then we'll see what the weather comes at us in 2016.
Bill, you had something you wanted to add.
Well, I was just going to say, I think the difference between a 1.3 carryout and a 1.5 carryout may not be as important as if it goes from 1.3 down to 1.1. Then that, from a price standpoint, that's you know, I think that's kind of the key level, that 1.2, 1.3 billion bushels. To really get a big price drive, I think you got to be down below those numbers.
But when a market rallies like that, though, the trade, the emotion gets to the point where they could start talking about something like that. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, at 1.3 rather than 1.1.
Yeah, and it's a dynamic situation. The price is going to determine where that demand comes in too, somewhat.
Producers probably have not, and I think this is right, have not done a lot of marketing up front for corn or soybeans at this point. And now, at least in the eastern Corn Belt, they're certainly hopeful that prices should move higher. I suppose a lot of that work can be done by the basis. But the numbers we've been talking about aren't that good. They're already looking at losses. How do they deal with the marketplace? Are there things that they can do and manage to help them out? And I'm not talking about for next year. I'm talking about for today, and I mean next year by 2016's crop, and for the crop that's in the ground. Anybody got good ideas as to what a producer ought to do?
I don't know if good ideas, but my ideas right now, I'm kind of like Dan. I'm looking for some cycle lows to be due as of right now. I see a market that's taken over 70% of the value back out from the damage we had. From what I see, that damage is still there. I don't know how many years I've seen beans have problem areas that turn green and look great until about September, and then they all die back off again from some other disease. And when that shows up, and I think we get the combines rolling, I think this market is going to go back up. So I'm looking at getting some calls bought, especially for end users, but even if these farmers want to have the courage to make some sales, you can buy these $4 calls for 16 and sell a 450 if you want to and come up with a 10-cent net. You can do March if you want more time, do a 4-450 bull call spread for 14, and the beans, a 960-1060 spread for 25 for a January contract. So that's what I'm looking to do right now. Hopefully that'll carry them through and we can lock in some prices and they'll have a better idea of what their yield's going to be, because probably my biggest problem right now, the guys just don't know what's out there.
Bill, do you have a plan?
Well, I think just first of all, I would say I think that your comment is true in the East. I think from what I see that there's a lot more sales on the books in the West than there is in the East. It's a lot easier to get guys to sell corn when they're looking at the crop they're looking at in Iowa, Minnesota, and Nebraska, I believe. But I like Merrill's comments. I think that's the you've got to look at your decisions as two separate issues, your cash basis levels and when you want to get those locked in, and your futures levels and how you want to manage that. And I think if you're in a situation where you're forced to make fall sales, I think you got to look at getting those done and then keep staying in the market somehow through calls or call spreads, bull call spreads. I think that's a good idea. I think the basis levels are probably, it's going to be an east-west situation there as well, and you're going to see a lot of the western corn will need to move to the east to cover, or move eastward, I should say, to cover some of the needs there. So I think that I probably would be more adamant as far as getting basis levels locked in the west than in Minnesota, for example, than I would in Indiana, for example.
Chad, I'll check with you, though I don't know whether you'll have an answer to that question. And I've got a second question for you as well.
Okay. Look here, I got to agree. Looking at that, breaking it into two separate decisions now, to me, makes a lot of sense, especially, as was mentioned, if you're looking here from the Western Corn Belt perspective, basis is going to be an issue when we get into harvest time, just because, the crop is looking good. We're going to have to break that apart. And so looking to gain that, or, at least utilize the idea of that, break that basics from the futures part of the sale and treat them as two separate entities as a way to move forward right now. The other thing I'm looking at is, was also mentioned here, is we've seen the market retrace a lot of the rally that it gave us with the damage to the crop, and it's one of these deals of I'm fully expecting another wave of that before we get finally to harvest time here. And so that offers some opportunity for some producers to possibly get out there and make at least a little futures move to put in a base floor, and as was mentioned before, use the calls or the call spreads to help give them some upside potential.
Before I get to the final word from each of you, Chad, I have one other question, and this will only be, I think, for you, unless somebody really has something they want to talk about. Cash rent for the coming year. If you've read, and most of the folks who listen to the show and my regular programming during the week on the Closing Market Report will know that Gary Schnitke and the Ag Economist here on campus have been saying cash rent needs to come down. This year they're looking at it and saying you have to really consider going into the next cropping year as to whether you need to cash rent acres that are really high priced. The land values and cash rent numbers were released by USDA yesterday. Did you go through them, and or do you already have some thoughts on what producers in Iowa might need to do? Because I believe, and I'd have to look, that you actually have the highest cash rent values in the nation. Not the actual highest cash rent, because I know that usually comes from Illinois, normally in Logan County, but the highest statewide average.
Statewide average, and one of the things that I noticed in looking through the USDA numbers that were just released, and it sort of backs up some of our own internal numbers that we've done with a survey here, is we are seeing those cash rents starting to erode downward. The USDA numbers, at least for Iowa, were down $10 year over year. We were down, with our internal survey, down 14 as we looked between the 14 and 15 crops. So It sort of makes sense. The idea is that cash rents, you know, in the end should reflect some measure of the value of income that can come off of that land. And since that income has declined over the last few years, one would expect the cash rents to follow suit. It just takes them a couple of years to really get moving in the same direction as we see the prices. And so I agree with Gary that we'll continue to see that number slide down. We are having some farmers make some tough decisions about whether to continue to rent some of the, especially the higher valued ground, higher rented value land out there. Or, you know, having that tough negotiation slash conversation with that landlord about what's feasible and reasonable as far as the cash rent is going forward. So just like I've described, you know, rents are like food prices. The idea is they can go up fairly quickly, but they hate to come back down.
All right, let's get a final word from each of you. I'll start with Merrill Crowley from Crowley Commodities out of Watseka, Illinois.
Well, I guess I don't have a final word. I'd like to ask one last quick question of
sure.
Dr. Hart. We keep hearing expansion in South America, yet we know the economies are pretty poor. That helps them in making their sales of their grain. But what about that expansion? Are they going to be able to afford to continue the expansion they've been seeing?
Well, the one thing I'm looking at there is, you know, I think short term, yeah, they may have some problems here. Longer term, though, I'll go back to some comments made earlier here. Long term, global demand should be strong enough to help pull that acreage in. Plus, with some of the infrastructure improvements we're seeing, especially in Brazil, I would argue it's going to make it easier, less costly to bring some of that land in and help make it more competitive. So, yeah, we'll continue to probably see that push coming out of South America.
Bill Mayer of Strategic Farm Marketing, you have a final word for the day?
Yeah, I just want to say that this coming week is a week we're all going to be looking at the crop report and what's going on in the United States, but don't be surprised if you don't see and hear more about the European situation and the drought over there. I think that's going to come to the forefront here as we move into the fall as well, and could have some impact on our exports as we go forward.
Dan Zwicker and I talked about that a bit on Thursday afternoon. Dan from CGB, your final word.
Oh, I think my neck struck out far enough by talking about a rally into December. So I think I'll leave it at that. So it can get chopped off pretty quickly. But I'm in the camp that we should see some kind of recovery, at least from this big July decline. And depending upon where the farmer's at on his production, there's always going to be risk in this market because we just don't know what we're going to wake up to the next morning. They need to take a look at, you know, covering the downside, but I still want to keep the door open for upside price potential.
And Chad Hart of Iowa State.
Well, not feeling like Dan. I stick my neck out pretty far, especially on the yield side, especially when like grunt. When you have an economist tell you a yield, you always have to wonder about that.
But you're out there.
Your state agronomist and is probably wondering what you're doing, too.
Probably so. But anyway, I'd say as I look at this market, one of the things that has been interesting to me to watch over the course of this, especially this summer, is this market, you know, has found, if you will, seemingly, you know, we sort of bounced off that floor. When we've been getting that December corn down in that 360, 370 range, we seem to bounce back up. We're hovering now in that 380. So it's like, you know, as was sort of said earlier, this market seems to have found its way lower and is looking for any reason to take it a little bit higher here if it can. And so, as was brought up before, the idea is, yeah, protecting the bottom side, getting some risk management in there, but leaving yourself open to the upside. Because, yeah, the market can and will surprise us at times, and we might as well let it surprise us in a happy way.
Chad Hart is the Extension Agricultural Economist at Iowa State University. He's based in Ames, Iowa. Our other panelists on Commodity Week for the 6th day of August have been Merrill Crowley of Crowley Commodities out of Watseka, Illinois, Bill Mayer of Strategic Farm Marketing from right here in Champaign County, and Dan Zwicker of CGB Enterprises in Mandeville, Louisiana. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find our programming online at WILLAG.org. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 12th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold is at agrigold.com.